Welcome to From the Trenches, success shortcuts revealed by real-world innovators crushing it right now. I'm your host, Scott Hartley, and we're back with another episode packed with actionable strategies from today's most successful entrepreneurs. If you're tired of generic business advice and ready for real cutting-edge tactics that are working right now, you're in the right place. Today, my guest understands the challenges of B2B buying journeys, which can sometimes be months or years long, and how hard it can be to build a consistent pipeline of prospects. And success in this area, as you've heard so many times on this podcast before, is intimately knowing your ideal customer by performing in-depth market and buyer research. And that's what Ryan Paul Gibson specializes in, is qualitative B2B marketing and buyer research. And he does this by conducting hundreds of interviews each year. He has over 22 years of experience in B2B. He's held senior positions in marketing, business development, and sales, and Ryan has worked for 3 years as an investigative reporter before returning to B2B marketing. Today, he's the founder of Content Lift, which runs B2B customer investigations to gather insights from marketing and sales programs. He works as a fractional senior marketer with a focus on content and product marketing, and he teaches customer discovery for early stage founders at an incubator in Ottawa, Canada. Ryan, I'm excited to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you, Scott. I do so much. It's funny hearing it back. You forget like how much you do, but that was
right?
Great. Thank you so much for the nice intro.
Absolutely. So I like the fact, you know, that you were an investigative reporter. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that because I've got a background of reporting myself. So back in high school, I was working for a high school newspaper, and our senior year, we had to publish an article, and I ended up interviewing Brian White's mom. He was the boy from Indiana who got AIDS way back when from a blood transfusion. And so our local newspaper picked up that story, ran it on the front page of the local newspaper. That's what got me a job at my local newspaper, and that carried me through my college years and everything. So I kind of have a little bit of background in reporting a little bit. So love to hear your story on that, and then just kind of like the journey of how you got into doing this B2B marketing research, and kind of like the meandering path that all of us entrepreneurs have had.
Well, I can answer the first question because it ties to the second, if that's okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I've been in B2B over 2 decades. I started working in the family business. We owned a franchise chain, a chain of coffee shops. So similar to like Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay.
And up in Canada. But Canada is interesting because because of our population size, you know, we were a mid-sized chain with like 120 locations, whereas in the United States that could just be one state that has 120 locations.
Anyway, right.
I digress. So I worked in the operations side when I joined the management team, because I'd started working in the stores when I was like 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the operations hat with a small marketing hat, because you were a scrappy team. And for people who might not be familiar with, you know, a consumer environment, because the whole idea of a franchise system is you create the marketplace that entrepreneurs buy into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a turnkey revenue system. That's the whole point. That's why you pay McDonald's like $2 million to build a store, because you can get revenue day one.
Right.
So my job was to build the marketplace. And in consumer environments, customer research is like gospel. You don't do anything without understanding how a market thinks and how they're going to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my experience from day one. And it's very expensive to do that work historically in consumer environment. So I did it all myself. I would do all the interviewing, person on the street type work. I do all the what they would call observational work, which you can do in B2B. But in B2C, that was me just like watching how we served customers in the stores, and like how did the lines move and timing things. It was very in-depth. I'd go into the stores of competitors, pretend I was a customer, ask them why they bought here.
Mm-hmm.
And people thought I was crazy, but it gets down to, you know, the fundamentals of how marketing has existed for like millennia, which is you have to segment buyers in the categories and understand how they make choices with their dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So I did all that, and it was great. That's really where my research journey started, to your second question. And then when I hit 30 years old, I was like, do I still want to do this? I don't know. I was having that sort of midlife crisis early. And I went back to school and took broadcasting because I'd always liked media. And that's when I got a job with the local newsroom here in Ottawa, Canada, for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It was on TV and radio. And that was fun. It was great. It was not my path. I quickly learned after a few years for a bunch of reasons, but that's okay. I learned a ton, Scott. Like, I learned so much.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
And that was really where the qualitative research side and the interviewing side really shaped how I approach things now. So then I went back to the B2B world, and instead of working in like the B2B, the consumer environment, like franchising, I went right into the B2B world. And it was so quickly apparent how the disconnect between marketing and customers in the market right away. And I think there's a whole bunch of reasons for that, which we could get into. But it was, I had come from an environment where I had complete access to customers and I dictated the strategy of how we like went to market. Now I was like being asked to spin up a case study and, yeah, I know you don't need to talk to customers. It's okay. Your job is to help sales. I'm like, what is going on? Am I in crazy town? Like, but anyway, there's a lot of reasons for that. But since then, I've been still adamant about, how markets and buyers make decisions is the core of how you grow and drive your strategic choices in the business. So I carried that through my career now. And then, as you mentioned, in the last few years, I went all in on what I would call market and buyer research. It says customer investigations, but I really live within the scope of market research, like from a historical standpoint. But my whole lens is I just need to understand how buyers think about their options in a market. Because if I understand that, then I can create marketing and sales programs that do a better job at getting their attention, staying top of mind. And when they prioritize a purchase, I will be hopefully the first one in their consideration set. Because if I'm first, I have the best chances of winning that deal.
Yeah.
So that's what I do now, because my whole philosophy is that if I can unlock that, it's going to make my life as a marketer and salesperson so much easier. And anyway, I'll stop there. It was a long answer to your two questions, but I wanted to give you the
No,
rundown.
that's gold because I think that so many times that we gloss over because as entrepreneurs, as business owners, we're more concerned about our product, our service, right? And we want to get that to market, we want to make sales, but we gloss over the work that needs to be done, just like you explained. If we don't have that intimate knowledge of who the customer is, why they would buy our product or service over whatever else is out there in the market in the same space, we're missing out on a lot of opportunity. And research shows that when you can really show up and the consumer, whether it's a B2B situation or a B2C, when the consumer says, "Oh my gosh, you're inside my head. You were thinking exactly what I was thinking. You're feeling the same way that I'm feeling." Like you have a much deeper connection, and like that's a default, like I'm going with you, right? So tell us a little bit more about, what you've seen in your research and like some of the successes that when you've worked with companies that they've really devoted the time and energy to doing this market research, how this has paid off for them.
Yeah, well, there's a variety of reasons why you would do, again, what I would call like market research. But, that part of like understanding the market and how people make decisions. Sometimes it's because you're trying to commercialize a new product. Sometimes it's because maybe you're entering a new market. You don't know a lot about these people. Sometimes maybe your sales have flatlined because markets aren't a stagnant thing, Scott. Like they move and shift throughout the time or throughout the months and years. A really good example to contextualize this is before the pandemic, what was the total market share and demand for video chat? What was it during the pandemic? What is it now as people push more return to office? Like it's not, these things are moving goalposts and moving targets, and you need to understand how you fit within this because the buyers look at you against everything else they can do. It's not, you know, when we look at business development, we historically would call them direct and indirect competitors. The classic example for this is like spreadsheets. You know, people still use spreadsheets for all sorts of things, even to like as their CRMs or they track deals and sales. Why would I use that when I can just download HubSpot for free? Right? Like there's all sorts of reasons buyers make choices and trade-offs. So, what I've seen, but to your question, like what do I see seen successes? I'll give you a really easy contextual example. It's on my website. I call it my one case study. And it's sort of a lark because, you know, sales always wants another case study, which is there's always valid reasons for that. But, you know, my approach is very similar with every single customer. The insights we get are different, but how I collect qualitative insights and do customer interviews and buyer interviews is almost identical. A company I worked with when I was still doing more fractional work called Rewind here in Ottawa, Canada. They had grown the business in the Shopify marketplace. And if people aren't familiar with Shopify, they are a software that lets you build e-commerce stores. They've done very well for themselves, and they've built a billion-dollar business. Rewind, like a lot of large software platforms, had an application or an app where you could back up all the data and all the pictures and everything that's inside your store. Because if all my stuff got deleted by accident or went down, store owners would instantly see their sales drop off, right? So they want to be able to restore all these things quickly because it was actually very easy to delete something and Shopify didn't have an undo button. So Rewind sort of created that. They'd done a really good job about building the business to about 3 million, 5 million annual recurring revenue USD, which is a really good small to medium sized business. That's a good success story. They wanted to grow. And like a lot of companies, you can grow either by building new applications or acquiring products. And they decided to acquire a product that was similar in their product portfolio, and it was a backup for GitHub. GitHub is the largest code repository in the world. That's how what most software developers use. So when they bought the thing, they bought the product, we took all the intelligence and all the persona work done by the founding team that had built this product originally, and we put it into action, thinking, okay, great, we're going to make all the money back that we just spent on the acquisition. And it went really nowhere. The sales team was just like raising red flags, and we know we're not the people coming in don't make sense. And my outreach, you know, people that are not understanding why we even want to talk to them. Like, there's a huge disconnect here. So I got tapped to try and understand what happened. Well, the first piece of the puzzle we figured out was we were selling to the wrong persona. The founding team who had built the product was trying to sell into developers because they were developers who would solve their own problem. And that's so many business owners start that way. They solve their own problem. There's nothing wrong with that. But is your problem represented in the larger market? That's the key thing to understand. So when we went and talked to developers, most of them are like, well, why would I do that? I can copy my repositories and just download it to my laptop. Who cares? Who cares is not a great business value proposition to build a business from, right? What the founding team had seen was a lot of early adopters who were like them, and they thought they could scale the business that way. What was interesting, though, when you dug through some of the early sales, there was a small subset of IT practitioners who had also bought this GitHub product. So we went and talked to them. And what we quickly realized was they contextually thought of this product so differently than the software developers did, even though the technology was identical and it was for the same product. For anyone listening who works in IT, you'll probably know the words I'm about to tell you, which is like disaster recovery or your disaster recovery strategy. They've been doing that with on-premise towers for years, and now as people have moved to the cloud, they're building disaster recovery strategies to deal with cloud applications. And all that means is if I'm running a business and, you know, the 40% of my operations are beholden to all these software tools we use, if the data goes away, I'm stuck. Like I'm just sitting there doing nothing. I can't actually do anything providing, creating value for the business. So the IT people who would get ticket after ticket of GitHub data getting lost didn't want to deal with that anymore. So they bought this tool. So the reason I'm giving you this example, Scott, is what I like this work because it shows you that even if you think you might think you know how your solution is going to fit in a market, but until you actually get out of the building, get out of your head, get out from behind the keyboard and start talking to people about like how they use these things and why, you might be missing a totally different market opportunity, or you might just be f stuck in sort of like, trying to grow when you're actually getting nowhere, right? So I hope that example answered the question, but that's like, to me, that's like the microcosm of why we do this work.
And I think that that's really insightful because a lot of times, and it's inevitable in business, we're going to hit brick walls. We're going to find obstacles and everything. And a lot of times, we can just give up. It's like, oh, well, this isn't, this product isn't going to work or this service isn't going to work. But just like you discovered, it wasn't the product or service. It was who's the ideal target market for that. And it's not, globally, the develop software developers, it's like, oh, it's the IT niche, right?
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
so it's like, you got to find the right market who you have that solution for and then understand why that they're wanting to use that. So I'd love to kind of explore a little bit. When you're doing this type of research, it's not just asking surface level questions. You've got to go deep to really be able to understand the why. Why are you not interested in it versus why is this beneficial for you? So I'd love for you to share a little bit, about, some of the questions, the types of questions that you kind of pose when you're doing this type of research for companies that people can kind of model. Obviously, we don't have time to go deep into everything that you do, but, just kind of a few examples.
I'm going to answer your question in a different way, and I don't mean to do that.
No,
It's
you're fine. However you want to take this is fine with me.
the top question I get is the one you just asked. Like, what should I talk about with people? What are the questions I should ask? And there's different philosophies on that from a research standpoint. Some people say have a list of questions. Some people say don't have any questions because the questions are going to sort of box in your thinking because you actually, from an investigative side, what happens is you start focusing on the questions and checking off the boxes as opposed to like listening to the conversation like you're listening to me now.
Yeah, that's
So
important.
I have a list of questions on my website. It's a free resource, and I invite people to go download it because if you, to your point, like if you don't haven't done a lot of this work, the conversations can be very surface level and you don't get the depth you need. What I say to people though is I have another document that people it's free, people can access it. It's a persona template. And personas get a bad rap because especially in B2B, because they're seen as like these, again, these like very surface level things that don't help you. So I built one that I think is valuable for B2B transactions. And because there's 10 things, 10 things I think you need to understand when it comes to B2B transactions and B2B buyers. So you can actually build programs that actually get their attention. And to use you said earlier, like, you create that moment where, oh, they get me. They're thinking about me in the right way. Because most of the times, buyer choices live in their heads. It's not a thing that's like this binary thing where they pick a choice, they pick some, they have a problem, and then they go and find a solution. What they're doing over months and years is they're prioritizing different problems based on all sorts of different factors, external and internal. And then as solutions sort of come into periphery, they're like, oh, that's interesting. Well, that's interesting. Oh, okay. And then when they go to prioritize a problem to solve because it maybe it's become untenable or the CEO has said, we got to fix that, their memory goes to find those things they already know. So we want to be the person that's planted that seed to your point and be like, oh, yeah, I remember them. They Scott got me. He understood that problem I was facing. I'm going to go reach out to him. So what are the 10 things you need to know to sort of be that company? First, you have to understand like their role, their responsibilities, and the firmographics they live in. So, what do they do? What do they care about? What are they on the hook for? What are they responsible for in the business? And I don't mean like a job description. It's like, how do they actually move the business forward with what they own, right? What are they on the hook for? And then the firmographics, because different business models based on industry or size or whatever are going to have different lenses about your product and viewpoints about your product. Like the director of finance for a nonprofit is going to be different than the director of finance for a Fortune 1000. Like they have different, needs and lenses and contextual viewpoints about market solutions. So you need to understand that at a very basic level. You need to understand the process that buyers want to improve. Most solutions support a larger process. So, let's just take email, like outbound email. That actually supports typically like the sales process, right? It's a part of it. It's not like the sales process. It's not the total way we prospect, but it helps support it. So, what is this process for them? How do they look at it? How do they gauge success in it? And where are they falling down? How do problems manifest there? Like, so where how are they encountering issues in that process that they might try and solve for them? Because I said that's where those things start. Any specific buying triggers? Sometimes buying triggers are just like a cat, problems become untenable, or it could be a specific thing like we have to go get our SOC 2 compliance now because if we don't get our SOC 2 compliance, enterprise companies won't buy from us. That's a buying trigger. Or, an acquisition, or they just raised a series of funding. That's a common one. Salespeople will often reach out after there's been a raise because they want to see if there's anything new they want to invest in. Trusted sources of information. So, how do they research? Where do they go to get their information? How do they keep their pulse on the industry of things that they're responsible for? How do they build a consideration set? So, what's the checklist of like what makes it into consideration set? We've talked a bit about that already. A lot of it is like pre-imprinted in your brain, but there's also things that are very important for them to say, okay, I'm going to evaluate these three companies, but not these three companies. Why? How do they then evaluate the people that are talking to sales, right? Because they are, when you are in a sales conversation, they're going through a script in their head like, yep, nope, nope, yep, nope. And sales is either doing a good job or a bad job. And we can understand, like, objectively outside of that conversation, what are they looking for? And how do we drop the ball and where do we win? What are the solutions they compare you against? Who's in the buying group? Most B2B solutions involve more than one person. The larger the deal size, the more people typically. And why do we win deals? Like if it's my company, what is our unique competitive advantage and why are people telling us they choose us? Those are the 10 things that I think you need to have. And it sounds like a lot, but I guarantee you, Scott, like if in a 40-minute conversation with one customer, you can go through those things really easily in depth and just really pick their brain about why us. So I hope that made sense, but like those are the things that I really try to get at because the questions just come out of those 10 topics. Like you just say, like, why do we win deals? You can say, so why did you choose us? What made us stand out? Was there anything that you were concerned about? What seemed like a risk in choosing us? What made you one of the questions I really love is like, was there anything you thought we were lying about? Stuff like that, where you're just trying to get to the objective truth of how people see you.
No, that's great. And I love the fact that you mentioned early on, there's two things that really stuck out to me is one, that you are listening. So it's good to have, a set of questions going into things. But like you said, if you just like, okay, I've asked the 12 questions, that I thought of, now you're not really, going outside of that and probably missing a lot of information. But when you're listening to what that person's telling you, then you can go down those rabbit trails that's where the gold is going to be, uncovered. But something else that you also mentioned as well is that, you're getting into, and I forget exactly how you phrased it, but what are they responsible for? Right. So again, and I feel like a lot of times that, especially in the B2B type of world, that people miss and they feel like, oh, it's a company buying from me, when in actuality, it's a human that's making the decision, yes, we're going to do business with you. So all sales are human to human. I don't care if it's a multi-million dollar company or if it's, a small business that's only making, $100,000 a year. All decisions are made on that human level. And so if we think about who's the person or the group of people that are making the buying decision, and like you said, how are they on the hook? You know, if this buying decision that they make goes south, what's at risk for them, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. And the reason I like those things and why I built it out this way, let's just, if I may, let's just take prospecting as an example, like how this would fit in. You know, because prospecting is really just networking. Businesses have been doing it for decades. When I was in the franchise system, like salespeople would come and prospect me, right? And some did a good job, some did a poor job. The more you contextually understand how these people do things, their environment around them, and finding the better fit, the better your time you'll spend, the time you spend prospecting will be more valuable, more fruitful. You'll see more engagement, and you'll see more return. Now, when they buy, could be 2 months to 2 years from now, right? And I think that's one thing people really struggle with in the B2B world. When I was in the franchise system, there was a vendor. I sat on them for 3 years before I knew day one I wanted to buy for them when I met them. But because of the contracts I had signed, and because I was in an environment where I had inventory that I had to get rid of, I couldn't just bring in a new supplier right away. There's reasons why they don't choose you right away. So a good salesperson will understand this, but they will. And all their quarterly touch points, whatever your cadence is, now that you have a good sense of who these people are, what they care about, what they're responsible for, and the type of business model they work in, when you do your touch points, you can send them things that either you create or you find in the environment that will help them do their job, help them with those processes they're on the hook for. That keeps you top of mind in B2B. Like, that's the stuff they care about. Wow, Scott, like, you know what? He's a good dude. Like, even if we don't have working together, they're sending me good stuff that's like really helpful. And even more, the net effect of that is that person will then recommend you to their peers because you've built trust and credibility with them. That's the key thing. All that's when you look at cold outreach and prospecting, I've talked to, like a few thousand buyers, and when you ask them why they reach out to a cold prospect or a cold email, because some do and some still buy from that environment. I know people have this like weird thing with cold outreach. It's because most people don't know how to do it well. So when you ask these buyers, why did you buy from this cold email? Well, it was totally relevant to what I did. And like they seemed like they knew what they were talking about. To use your words, they totally got me. Like they understood my problem in the email. Now, whether that person reaches out now or 6 months from now, that's another whole other conversation, but you got them now because you showed that you understand them.
No, that's great. So another question that I have is that and I assume you're probably familiar, with the Dream 100 list or like who
Yeah,
your
absolutely.
ideal customers and everything are. Let's say that if you are a business and you've got your Dream 50, your Dream 100, is it worth saying, okay, I'm going to take 10 or maybe even all 50 of those, and I'm going to reach out to those businesses, not in a way like, hey, I want you to do business with me, but hey, I'm doing market research and seeing if they're willing to, give you some time so that you could start to do that type of investigative work that we've just been talking about. Do you recommend that businesses do that so that they can start kind of like building up that knowledge base so that when they are ready to then, prospect that potential list, 6 months from now or whatever, that they've got that already done.
I do. There's different ways people think at that about that. I think short answer is yes. I think you have to be prepared for n not a lot of responses. The average response rate in a research environment for cold outreach for one-on-one conversations is at best 30%, which is still pretty good. Because in a solicitation context, it's going to be dramatically lower. But we also, like I said, you could argue that are you doing it right or wrong, and so on. There are some people who will say that there's a term I saw the other day called cataloging, which is an old school term where it's you just reach out to a company on your Dream 100 list and say, "Hey, Scott here. What are you using to solve these problems? I'm just curious. I'm just getting a sense of like, what people are using these days. When are your contracts up? Can I maybe schedule a meeting with you, 12 months from now, just talk about that," right? That's one way to do it. Again, you got to be prepared for not a lot of maybe responses there. But at the end of the day, I like reaching out and saying, "Listen, I just want to talk about your business. I'm very curious about you. I'm curious about how you think. I'm hearing these things from some of your peers. Just want to understand if you're seeing those things too. This is not a sales conversation." The trick is, though, Scott, you have to stay true to that, because the minute you switch things to a sales conversation, you are it's done. One, you've killed trust and credibility, and two, people's they actually shift in how they think about the context of the conversation now. That said, if you do your job well in this environment, and this happens with me today when I do interviews, when I teach customer discovery for the early stage incubator in Ottawa, I say this to the founders, and there's actually salespeople that will come in and marketers. I said, if you do your job well about trying to understand the 10 things that I talked about, they will be curious about what you do at the end of the conversation, really, and how you can help. Because what you've shown them is some respect about understanding them and showing that you're trustworthy, or like you've built some level of trust. So at the end, they might even ask you, "You know what? I'm really curious to hear more about what you do. Let's talk a bit about that. Let's maybe schedule a call in 6 months." So yeah, I think people should try at least, because if you go out to that Dream 100 list cold and just try to do what people do now, which is, "Hey, do you want to see a demo? Hey, do you want to see a demo? Hey, can you get a demo? Can I get on your calendar?" Your response rates are going to be almost zero, I guarantee you.
It's goes back to that saying, is that people want to be understood. And so when you approach it from, hey, I want to understand you, I want to understand your buying decisions, I don't have an ulterior motive, there's not, I'm not trying to sell you anything, I really want to know, like, what makes you and your company tick, what makes you decide who you're going to do business with, and you're genuine about that, like, I mean, that's just going to show up totally different the way than most of the market shows up in the
Absolutely.
sales world, right?
And if I may, if you do that work, whether it's a salesperson or a marketer that does that, because that's really what you're talking about, lives under the banner of market research historically, not just in a sales context, an outreach context, but you could then create a webinar with like, "Here are the five core problems that we hear about from the market. Here's five ways to address those." And that's like a one-to-many scenario that marketing can help run, doing the exact same thing, using the exact same intelligence that then those people who sign up for the webinar could be soft leads for the sales team to reach out to.
And the beauty of that is that, if you've done that research, and something that I teach my clients is, how can you use the words of your prospects in
Absolutely.
all of your marketing, tools? Because if you've got that data, now you just feed the words right back to them. You're going to get people to sign up for that webinar or read sales material, whatever that looks like.
Absolutely.
So I know we're getting close on our time here. Are there any final thoughts that you would like to share? And I know that you've got a couple resources that you mentioned a little bit earlier, if you want to kind of like dive a little bit deeper into those.
So the one thing that I always like to tell people, and I've been writing about it a lot recently, is, the B2B world is a team sport. And we often get into our siloed into our first perspective disciplines, which is very natural to do, right? But I think we always have to remember that value in a business, and when you create and bring value to a market, the ways you do that exist whether there's a team of 10 or a team of 1,000. Like, it's the same motions. It's just they get broken up in different teams. So you always have to work together to figure out how are we both work, how are like marketing and sales working together to bring people across the finish line. And I think that's always something we need to remember and be respectful of, and go talk to your colleagues about like what they believe to be true and like what do they know, right? And because it's so we make assumptions so easily, but what we think is happening based on our small lens of the market. The more you can talk to each other and then get out of those environments and like get the customer's point of view, the easier you will find your job and the more success you will have. But yeah, the two resources I have on my website, they're free. Like you don't have, they're there. You don't have to like add your email. You can if you want, because I do have a newsletter, but I don't like that. I like here, just take it because I want people to get better at this, right? So yeah, there's a list of questions, and that buyer persona template, which I go into like the history of segmentation, which is actually thousands of years old as a practice, which people don't realize.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. They started segmenting buyers in the Bronze Age.
Oh,
Like
wow.
it's that's how long we've been doing this. And people just don't understand the history of this stuff. But that's okay. So I get that resource is there, and I really think people should look at it and take it to heart because I think it'll provide a lot of value when they think of the marketing and sales programs. And also, Scott, people can just find me on LinkedIn. I try to answer every message I can. I'm always happy to help people.
Awesome. Well, Ryan, I really appreciate you sharing all of your insights today. This has been very valuable, and I think it goes back to the core of what we as business owners really need to be doing is really deeply understanding our market so that we can, that's how we have success. Because without our customers, we can't make sales, right? And the only way we're going to really scale up is when we are top of mind and we're resonating with our ideal customer. So I appreciate your time here today. Remember, go get your B2B buyer persona guide and the 184 customer interview questions at Ryan's website, and that's at contentlift.io. We'll make sure that we put the website address for both of those resources in the show notes, and then also Ryan's LinkedIn page, so that you can connect with him. I'm sure that if you've got questions, he'll be happy to answer those. Or if you want to engage the services to do the customer research for you, you guys can have that conversation. And if you're looking to supercharge your email marketing, check out my book, Hit the Inbox, at hittheinboxbook.com. It's packed with 76 pages of strategies to get your emails landing in inboxes and driving sales. Thanks for tuning in today. If you found value in this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps us reach more entrepreneurs like you. And until next time, keep crushing it in the trenches.